Are we ever going to make this dream a reality? Are we going to...
And now look.
And now we're here in the studio. Humble beginnings.
This is it, exactly, yeah.
There's no one here to produce us. This is self-produced. Wow. So apologies for the chaos. So I guess the first place to start is, obviously, we've dropped this film.
People are using survivors and victims of child sex abuse for their own political gain, and it's got to stop. It's got to stop.
None of my friends have come here raping any women.
What the fuck?
Reform UK's biggest rally ever was how they were promoting it. Were there as many people there as you thought there would be?
To be fair, I don't know. It matched my expectations of people. I don't know. It felt like enough for their first time thing. So
we're not America. Like, we don't do big rallies. We're not at that stage yet of being India either. Like, Modi does these rallies apparently where he's like projected like a hologram.
Oh, mad.
We're not doing that, bro. We're definitely also, not doing that.
Also, I don't
that.
Think there's much of an appetite in this country to do that kind of stuff.
No, because we want to chill. We want to be at home drinking tea. I mean, I don't like to lean too much on that stereotype, but we are... That's what we do.
Really. Yeah, literally,
we sit at home, we have a chin wag, we complain.
Watch the TV.
Yeah, we'd watch it on TV.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd watch a hologram on TV.
Although, to be fair, I think with the theatrics, it kind of looks better on TV than in person. So maybe the whole point is just to get
a headline.
Yeah, exactly.
That is a bit of a reform thing, isn't it? I thought the biggest rally ever, you felt as if it was going to be teeming with people. And we pulled up in the car, found a space pretty easily in the allocated car park. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, not kind of swarmed and with people.
People were dribbling in. I mean, there was a constant dribble of people coming in, but it wasn't maxed out in the way that I thought that these lot were going on about. No. So,
but that's the zeitgeist, apparently, according to one of the people we interviewed when we were there. Let's start with why we went.
Well, I think, do you know what? The world is just so strange and it's becoming so polarized that we just want to see what the hell is going on and just get a feel of what is this new thing that is happening. Because I think it's new kind of for everybody, everyone in political life, people who aren't involved in political life. There is something, we're on this kind of precipice of something new. I don't know, at least it felt on my part that we were there to just listen, absorb, learn, understand, and see what maybe some of the challenges are today. But what do you think? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, we're just two curious guys, man. We're just two curious guys trying to find out what the hell's going on in the world.
Dude, like, oh my God. Like, can we talk about, like, the political and economic state of the world right now?
Feeling Jaden Smith about it all. My feet, you know, why I wanted to do this project was that it doesn't really exist, really. There's not a lot of podcasts out there. Like, I'm addicted to news. My background was in journalism, as you know. I'm still addicted to political podcasts, but I've never felt that there was anything that was talking specifically culturally to, like, what we're interested in. You know, I love door knocking as an experience. Like, I know a lot of people don't, who do political campaigns, they don't enjoy necessarily being confronted by the electorate because... It's essentially chaotic, it's random.
Yeah, it's quite abrasive as well. I mean, for so many people, you've got such a big political subscription. Your belief system, your value system is all of a sudden kind of confronted with somebody who is just rightfully going about their day. Politics might be the last thing on their minds. I guess my curiosity also comes as someone who stood for Parliament at the last election, who kind of holds kind of centre-left ideas about how we should arrange our society, how we can alleviate some of the challenges around poverty, inequality, maybe conversations around our institutions, our constitution, whatever it may be. As someone who kind of holds a particular political system, I'm also mindful that the world is changing and we've got to understand
rapidly.
If anybody wants to go out and make a change in their society, they've kind of got to understand the society that they're kind of living in, the developments that are occurring. And I think it would be quite ignorant of someone like me, but maybe people like us who are genuinely curious and want to make some type of change, it would be a bit ignorant for us to just say we can do it without trying to understand what the world is
100%,
actually like.
100%. There's a disconnect right now between Westminster and the electorate.
Genuinely feel that the majority of politicians these days are they're just in it for their own ends.
I saw a tweet the other day about Josh Simons, who's one of the new MPs. It was basically saying that Josh Simons had been privately educated, he'd gone to Oxbridge, then he'd gone to Harvard, then he'd worked mostly in politics, and then now he was complaining about the fact that there's no trust in politics. And I'm going, okay, shit, like, that's kind of my my background as well, just to be upfront. But like, fair, I hear you. Like, there is a massive disconnect at the moment. The only way you're going to solve that disconnect, though, is to have conversations directly with those people, to come with humility to those conversations and say, look, I don't know, you know, intimately what it's like to experience what you're experiencing, but I care. I also want to create a political system that enables those people, especially ones who are in public services, people who are working jobs, who are on the breadline at the moment, who are really struggling with poverty, to be supported by the state in a way that works best for them to live a meaningful life.
I think also in all of that as well, it demonstrates how much of maybe a credentialized society we've become, where if you've got a certain background or a certain qualification, that means that you have credence over a certain particular philosophy or how to do things. And I think that needs to be broken. We need to kind of understand that irrespective of your background, what your qualifications are, where you come from in the country, you have something to say. And yes, our system embodies a lot of those people who may be qualified to the hilt but may not have the same experiences as most people. We're trying to kind of do the inverse of that and actually just understand what the hell is going on.
Yeah, and I think class has to be a central part of what we're talking about. Like, what does class even mean in the modernized political landscape that we live in, especially when Reform and the Tories have cut through those traditional dynamics in which we've understood them, those frameworks, in a massive way? Is it about how much you earn? Is it about whether you earn a property? These are like important questions that the left need to be asking itself if we're going to build a new coalition.
Yeah, definitely. They're fundamental questions to the type of society we live in. And I would go one step further. It's not just about class, even though that's important. It's also, and not to be kind of a first year uni student about it, but literally like the institutions and structures of modern day capitalism. Why are these things manifesting in the way they are? How can we seek to redress some of the extremities that have now been able to take place as a consequence of a particular model of capitalism? I think these whole things need to be completely reevaluated. We need to interrogate what they are and hopefully have some answers that provide a sustainable solution for the future. Otherwise,
otherwise we're cooked, bruv.
Well, yeah, it's mad.
We're cooked.
People are just going to keep going in one direction. People are going to go down another direction, and people won't be able to speak to each other for a whole range of issues. And we're just trying to understand.
I dare say, Jovan, you sound quite radical in that approach. Well, I'm all ears. We're completely open-minded about what the solutions might be. As we can all tell, the last 9 months of a new Labour government have not been easy by any stretch of the imagination. We are still two Labour people. We're two supporters of the party. We want to see the party succeed, but we want it to see it succeed by making things better. Okay, cool. So let's start off with, like, we walked up the parade on the way to the arena, and the first person we get confronted with is this activist, Dave Sharp. We saw these massive posters about the grooming gangs, and I thought, fuck, right, let's talk to this bloke and figure out what's going on.
We're not a political party. We're survivors and campaigners of child sex abuse. And all we're asking is, for once, please, let's all come together and put our children first.
I mean, what was your main takeaway from that?
I mean, I found his kind of insight, his experience, his contributions just so fascinating. He was leaning on his own experience as someone who was a victim of a horrible circumstance. And yet in all of that, it was being used as kind of a political football from the government, from people in Reform, people in the Tory party. And yet in all of it, people like him and others were completely lost as part of the conversation. I'd say quite distressing at times to hear of some of his experiences, but I think even more so, it was quite offensive just to know that people were kind of weaponizing and exploiting his experiences to get some form of political gain, which, I don't know, it left an odd taste in my mouth.
Obviously, the grooming gangs inquiry has been used a lot in comms by Nigel, and then, as he said, he backtracked, but then Rupert Lowe's kind of picked up this mantle since he's been expelled from Reform. He's kind of using it as a way to kind of cohere his fringe of the party, I guess, who are thinking that Reform aren't Reform enough.
And we say this message to Mr. Lowe, who's come out today saying he's going to do a national inquiry. You need to talk to the people with the real lived experience. We're crying out for our voices to be heard.
None of them have spoken to any victims or survivors.
Yeah, no.
So these people who are trying to champion themselves as like, we're going to be, you know, the people who are going to find justice on this issue, are not engaging with the people who matter most around this absolutely awful, horrendous issue.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
And I'm just thinking, well, yeah, thank you, Dave, for saying rightly it should not be a political football, and the massive failings institutionally as well. And I guess the truth is that multiple governments were in charge when this thing happened, right? We had, it was Tony Blair to Gordon Brown to then under the Tories as well. We know that there's grooming gangs still happening today, mm-hmm. if you listen to the experts. And it is cross-cultural. So Dave mentioned Beastie House, which is this case that's just happened in Glasgow. I read there was a Sky News bulletin on it yesterday. They'd done an investigation into it. The KC involved, who was defending the children, has basically said he'll never take a case again about child sexual abuse. That's how traumatized. Yeah, that's how traumatized from this one particular case of all the institutional failings around these children who should have been in care, which again, that's Dave's lived experience as well. It's worth flagging, right, that Dave has gone to prison. I don't think that necessarily discounts him from being someone you can listen to.
Yeah, in terms of drawing on his experiences.
You know, Dave's been through a lot. He's been through tons. I can't imagine the amount of suffering that he's endured, not just when he was a child, but also on the streets of, it sounded like London and other cities for 25 years as a drug addict. You know, I spoke to Dave on the phone, really, and I was almost overwhelmed by the energy that he has to talk about this topic. It feels, I guess, for him that it's reaching a crescendo now. Like, for so long, this wasn't talked about. Mm-hmm. But then it's kind of been, you know, the awareness of it's happened in one of the most difficult ways possible, where Elon Musk has been the person amplifying all of that.
Exactly. And it's come mislabeling communities up and down the country, ascribing particular traits unto particular people, really creating enemies and weaponizing narratives against people. And it's just, it's a really unfortunate way in which the whole conversation has sparked and the characters that have been involved to propagate the conversation. And in all of it, as we say, people like Dave and others have been completely ruled out of the conversation. Yeah, their voices haven't been accommodated. They haven't been listened to. They haven't been used as a form of expertise. And where government has acted, it also hasn't acted. It's kind of had a shyness about responding to some of these issues. And this is leading to so many people just feeling as though there is no trust, no confidence, and no desire on the part of government to actually do anything to fundamentally address this without trying to get some political gain out of it, which, again, is just awful.
It's a death spiral.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
A death spiral, especially when it's the worst crimes possible. Like, and I don't know, you know, why it hasn't been dealt with properly. It feels like the fact the government tried to do the right thing when all the attention was being poured onto it by saying we're going to implement the recommendations of the Jay report, which, by the way, was commissioned under a Tory government, and the Tories had all the recommendations in their hands and they didn't do anything about it, right? So it's about action. It's just not about noise anymore. It's about action. It's about doing things to make sure that this never happens again. And the facts are, unfortunately, horribly, this happens a lot. So you know, we're really going to have to look at ourselves in the mirror as a society to really understand this problem in more intricate, finer detail, and give institutions the robust powers they need to be able to prevent it.
Well, this is it. We've got to ask kind of more fundamental questions about
definitely
how and who is administering power, where does institutional accountability lie, and how does the state respond to these heinous, horrific things that are going on.
This is why you should be boots on the ground. You feel me? Like, this is why you kind of have to be there sometimes and talking to people, like,
and develop community relationships and understanding.
We're living in a world where there's essentially no curbs on the internet, at least in terms of free speech, right? Like, that's the whole Musk thing. You know, Meta have bent the knee now to Trump, and there's going to be so much bad information out there that journalists in particular, and we're not journalists, we're just people who are going to use the fundamentals of journalism. You know, we're politics people, really, but I only think politics, left-wing politics, finds a way out of this mess through the truth. Like, just through, like, you can't let Steve Bannon say to the MAGA lot, we're the people of radical honesty, you know, we'll release the unredacted JFK files, we'll release MLK, by the way, there's no new information in any of those things, but let them have a win where they pretend that they're the people who are the guardians of truth.
This is it, and also the arbiters of truth. I think we've just got to be gung-ho about fact and truth. I mean,
and bias, right? Like, we have to say, like, everyone has a lens on the world, everyone has principles that they look at, that they look at the world through. The reason why the BBC is struggling, for instance, is because BBC wants to present itself as objective, and it's the closest to kind of British truth as you can get, right? If you cash in and price in all of the assumptions and the biases that give us a lens on the world. And I think, by the way, I'm a I back the BBC. I think they do a great job most of the time. And I think they should be protected very much so. If you want fact-based news, go to Reuters, go to AP, read a news line, right? There is no, like, dressing of the language, okay? It is just fact, fact, fact. It's very boring. Fact, fact. And I will also say that in the current system that we're living in, guess who was banned from the White House? The Associated Press. Yes. So the people who are actually interested in making sure that there is fact-based journalism around the world were told, you can't have a pass to report on what's happening in the White House. But Fox News, please come in. In fact, actually, we'll take a few of your guys and we'll put them in offices of supreme importance. This is like the wildness that we're living in.
Yeah, I mean, and it's that kind of, when you implement cynicism amongst the public in a way that is unfounded and unfair, unreasonable, and completely mistruthful, that is floundering in the face of democracy as well. I mean, how does anybody have confidence in democracy to facilitate or realize the goals that it's meant to if it's not seen as a sycophant for the government? And this is the era that I fear that we're in, where media, post-truth, questions around legitimacy and illegitimacy are becoming so mainstream that we almost don't have time to to counter it. We've just got to be kind of
it's demoralizing to wrap your head around it by design. Like, that's what Flood the Zone, Steve Bannon's tactic, was all about, was to make discombobulate the left or progressives, liberals, so that they can't focus on one thing. They're just constantly trying to put out fires, and that's why there's news avoidance. News avoidance is not just because there's loads of bad shit happening in the world, which there is, and there's always, which also there's always been, right? If anything, there could have been even more worse stuff happening simultaneously in the past than right now. But when we've got a system which enables, like, there's no dam in place to stop this information from us, you go on Twitter, if you're still on there, and you will see next man getting shanked in a cab, bro. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've all seen that video. Like,
and that will be then a misrepresentative portrayal of maybe London or a big city or something else. Yes, so then it has another or layer even, on top of it as well.
Black people. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a radicalization that's happening where someone sees crazy thing happen on internet and thinks, in basic terms, well, those people do those crazy things. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think we will have to explore loads about what are the right checks and balances that you're meant to have on the internet, on social media, the online safety bill.
I think we've got to embrace it for the future, but the type of future that we want for ourselves. Yeah. And I think we haven't really considered what is that future that we all want to see. Everyone, like when we went to the Reform Rally, everyone recognises that something's going wrong, but there seems to be such division amongst the solutions. And yet, if we all spoke to each other, we could probably find potentially more in common than what separates us, but we still haven't really fixated ourselves on what does that sustainable future look like for everybody. Instead, we're just so haste to give a brash and provocative opinion on social media, and that is obviously to the detriment of everyone.
So we were trying to touch grass, weren't we, by going there? We were touching political grass, which meant going directly to the rally. After we spoke to Dave, there was Kfence, there was with his mate.
We are just here to try to have a conversation with people that are coming to this Reform conference.
The idea of what they were trying to do, the project of it, was very noble. It was a recognition, I felt, that counter rallies serve a purpose, but in a really divisive world where it's super hard to build coalitions, you're not going to change these people's mind unless you engage with them, which is, I think, what we believe in.
Yeah, exactly. And in all of that, what we noticed was that there is an appetite for people to bridge some form of divide. People want to communicate. People do want to engage. People are curious, irrespective as to which wing of politics they're on. It's how we go about doing that. And I think those two definitely embodied and epitomised people coming together and just trying to understand what is going on. So I don't think we're in a minority per se in terms of wanting to explore and engage, but it's quite a majority, I think so, but I think maybe people were in an environment where people may not have the confidence to feel as though that's what they can actually do. They can still have a value system, they can still hold kind of a particular type of politics, but in all of it, like, we're not just sat in our echo chambers and we want to explore and understand why people are turning towards alternatives.
He thinks that a lot of Reform voters are non-voters as well, who are finding a voice for their feeling of being left behind, ignored, by the political class in this country for just too long. And like one piece of data that I just don't think is spoken about enough is that turnout at the last election was about 60%. So 40% of people didn't vote.
Did not engage.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's it's very close to 50-50. You know, I mean, it's closer to 50-50 than 75-25, right? So massive alarm bells, because if Reform are able to give a voice to a section of society that essentially gets sifted through the data can't capture these people because they just don't care about the political system. They've always believed it's broken and they've refused to engage with it. And yet there's a new thing that's saying, actually, come over here. Yeah, come over here. We'll give you a voice. We'll channel you. You know, that is going to be completely
that will upset,
I don't know if it's the silent majority. I think it's a silent block that's definitely going to carry a lot of weight going forward, and I think we'll see some of it in the local elections, but really we'll see it at the general. If they can turn them out, these silent non-voters, in the local elections, where essentially people don't really care, like people don't vote in local elections, more or less, like turnouts tends to be around the 30% mark, like if they can turn them out there to a place where they shouldn't really ever be like getting involved, then they will definitely be riding out for them come 2029. All eyes on the locals, bro. I'm very, very interested to see what the numbers are looking like. I guess this is a good segue into talking about whether we really think that Reform is the genuine opposition. What do you think?
I think they're fast becoming an opposition, and I think they're becoming an opposition in part because it seems as though the government's responding to them now. And they're starting to take seriously the concerns that Reform potentially present to Labour voting areas.
So do you think
areas.
The government should be responding to them?
Well, I think the government are the ones that empower. And I don't just think that. I kind of know that as much as anyone else does. And I think they've got to govern with their own value system, with their own political programme, and not be so concerned. Yes, you have to keep an eye on your kind of opponents that are coming through, but at the same time, if you're kind of gung-ho with your political program, have confidence that you're doing what is the right thing to be doing, what is needed for the country, and what is going to be better for your constituents. And I think, to a point, the over-focus on Reform could be something that is creating them to be an opposition, more so than the fact that they are default becoming an opposition within themselves.
So I'm going to disagree with you here. I think that Reform is a lot of it is vibes based, right? It's anger, it's emotional, it's about feeling forgotten and left behind and needing something new, ripping up the rule book, right? Which I think a lot of people are also landing on, as we saw with the left-wing people we spoke to at the rally.
At the moment in Britain, there's a lot of despair, and the far right can feed off of that. What we've actually got to do is create a massive movement.
But I think there are some substantive bits to their analysis, right? Specifically on the economy. We know what they stand for, right? They want to lower taxes. They want to essentially turn the UK into as much of America as it can as possible. There's something that they are responding to on immigration as well, which I also think is real. I say this with a heavy heart, mate, because I'm not anti-immigration. I'm pro-migration. But, and this is a capital B, but I think we have to lower it, because if you keep having a mandate from successive government to successive government for lower immigration, and then you don't give those people that thing,
well, this is it.
Then they're going to lead to a place of distrust. And I think that's where Reform, you know, aren't vibes based. They are, I mean, like they're giving an option, which, by the way, would never work. Net zero immigration would absolutely decimate our public services. We are so reliant on migrant workers at the moment to prop up our public industries. My feeling is that they are responding directly to something that is actually happening in the world. And so as a government, you have to do that as well. And it's going to be uncomfortable for us. We're Labour people, of course.
Yeah, no, but I also think at the same time, like, where is that balance to be struck? And we haven't had that conversation about the balance that needs to be taken between what is necessary and needed for the country as it stands today, and what then becomes, to a point, an exploitation of the nation's borders, which I think is, to a point, some of the conversations that are being had. We don't really understand the contributions that are being made by migrant communities, but also the contributions that these people will play in the future as Britain hopefully becomes a more prosperous country going forward. There isn't a coherent conversation, I think, that is framing the migration discussion. So I don't know, I think it's quite easy to say, well, Reform just have the answers because they're leaning into...
Well, not necessarily the answers, but they're responding to the right questions.
They're responding to the right questions, but I don't think we've been curious enough onto the nuances of those questions, even still.
No, I think we're still struck. Like, it's not natural for left-wing people to talk about immigration.
Mm.
It's just not. I mean, they just, you know, we want to just see the positives in it. And there are plenty of positives in it. But there's also, you have to acknowledge, cultural consequences when you have, you know, record numbers of people coming into this country. It's unprecedented. I mean, if you look at it on a graph, it is. Look, my family, Windrush generation immigrants, well, yeah. just like so, yours, yeah. mm-hmm. you know, on my mother's side, my dad's side are Australian and came over to the UK. So I'm a Commonwealth baby. I know you are as well.
Yeah.
And like, I think there is a shared heritage of Britishness that is not at all linked to race. And it's not about whiteness.
It's a collective history. And I think particularly... Yeah. if we're looking at over the last 20th century, where we see that the contributions of people in this country have come from all around the world, but particularly people who have come from the Commonwealth. What's interesting is the population has increased almost exponentially since I was born in 1996 to now, in a way that has probably been a lot more concentrated than throughout the period of Commonwealth migration. That is something that is quite clear and easy to say. It's how does the country then respond to these new waves of immigration, these new types of immigration? Is the kind of labour capacity here? And it's not to say it isn't, but where is that workforce going? Where is the structures, the infrastructure being implemented to accommodate said people? But also culturally, how are we evolving? How are we becoming a lot more accommodating, but without losing a sense of the collective story that unites us all as British people. Mm. And again, this reevaluation of what Britishness is, what our value system is, all needs to form part of this discussion, because for people like both of us who are British people but have an intricate history all around the world, I've got Jamaica, Ghana, India, Birmingham, where I'm from, all inside of me.
Birmingham's a country as well. But,
it's wild, and I think that's not... We haven't caught up to actually how fast and how changing this country is, and
let me pick up on so there's two things there. One, we need to use this podcast to discuss, you know, for an open forum, essentially, what British values is. What is Britishness? Okay, we need to have some sort of substantive conversation about that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the way we're going to unite under multiple different banners of ethnicity, for instance. But you have to be proactive about that. I think we've done laissez-faire, and this is where what we've got right now is people essentially living in, you know, disparate groups, disparate identities that don't necessarily...
Well, there's no attachment to anything in all of that.
And that's problematic. I think that's a problem. I think that's a problem. So the second thing I want to talk to you about was Birmingham in particular, because obviously Birmingham's been in the news recently because of the refuse workers have gone on strike. So what I was really struck by was that, and this is why I think Reform is making moves to be a genuine opposition, maybe not the opposition. It seems it's a 3-horse race now. We're all kind of polling around the same numbers. But Nigel Farage did not attack the unions. And I thought that was fascinating, because you would expect Farage, the lover of Thatcher, you know, he's made a big deal about her in the past, to be anti-union. But because of the British Steelworks, because of what's happened in Birmingham, because he wants to widen his tent, he's saying...
It's very convenient for him to align himself with unions and kind of workerist movements. And I think this at times can be a problem. Yes, the Labour Party is the party of work, and I guess it's important that we subscribe to kind of, at times, a workerist kind of ideology and value system. But if that is not underpinned by any form of actual coherent social and political thinking, it can be approximated really by anybody. And that's what I think we're seeing with Nigel Farage, is that he's able to jump on the bandwagon of the unions and show, to his point, his support of that, because that's cheap and that's going to get his votes, when he doesn't really stand on the side of workers when it comes to employment rights, when it comes to maybe discussions around wealth redistribution, when it comes to further struggles down the line with their unions. So this is a guy who is saying the populist stuff quite literally because it's popular. He knows that could be a convenient way to get him votes and get him to the position that he wants to be in. But in all, it's completely rendering and undermining the interests of working class people, as far as I see it.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the TUC went to Clacton and Vox Pop, some of the people there, and said, you know, did Nigel Farage vote for any of the amendments for workers' rights that have been pushed through in the past 9 months? And guess what? No, he didn't.
So there is a bill proposed in Parliament right now.
Right.
That is to get rid of all these bad practices.
That'd be good.
Any idea someone who voted against the bill?
Business people, obviously.
The employer. Company owners.
Shall I give you a clue? Your MP.
Nigel. No. No,
he's already got a parliamentary record of not being on the side of workers. I mean, that's kind of what you need to look at.
But there will be people who are going to be buying into it, is my thing. And they're not going to be buying into it because of Nigel Farage's track record. They're going to be buying into it because Nigel Farage talks like me, thinks like me, represents my values. What's really interesting to me is that this shift has happened now, right? So for years, Farage has been in the wilderness. He's been this fringe character, but he's been building up this whole time a lot of respect, a lot with the people who have money. Like Nick Candy, the Reform treasurer, is he's big money, you know. That's his background, is about, you know, rubbing shoulders with other people of extreme wealth. And that's why they brought him in, because, by the way, he's going to make them way more money than the Tories are currently. They're gonna. It looks like they're gonna have to close their Northern HQ because of how many donors have abandoned the party. Again, another reason why I think, okay, maybe Reform are more of an opposition right now than the Tories. That's a huge impact, and we know this as people who've worked for the party, that money coming into the party is essential for what you're able to do.
Resources.
Yeah, it's huge.
Campaigning.
It means that, like, I wouldn't have been hired if the Labour Party weren't able to expand its digital offering. And they were able to expand it because they had enough support for the party, because people were thinking that, hold on, we need to get these guys into government because the Tories have fucked it up so much, right? Yeah. My point is that Farage himself has been building up credibility with people of extreme wealth for a really long time. Just like who? Just like Trump.
No, just like Trump.
And and what did Trump do? He built a coalition through places that have been destroyed by deindustrialization, that have been decimating their communities by Thatcherism, or in America it would have been Reaganism. And he said, you know, you're on my team. I'm going to back you guys. Protectionism, isolationism, etc. And that we can create a new coalition through that front. And they did it. That's what they did.
And that's because, in all, he had the resources and campaigning materials to be able to do
he
so.
Had the mullah, bro. That's he had it. The dinero, bro. He had the peace. And so this is why I'm going, okay, like, strap in, guys, because the Tories would never be taken seriously in Wales, for instance, right? And Wales, they've got Senate elections next year. Reform will do shockingly well in
that, of course, in that election. And they also represent a kind of new vanguard, a new kind of entryist organisation in the parliamentary system. They attract curiosity and interest because they're something new. We haven't really seen the birth of a new movement, the style of Reform, almost probably since the birth of the Labour Party. 125 years ago, we haven't seen this kind of potentially popular uprising of people who are speaking to material circumstances and are having quite an explicit answer to a problem. And that is attracting curiosity. So the traditional right-wing parties probably won't get the same look. Well, they don't, as you say, in Wales and other parts of the UK. But potentially something interesting, something arguably innovative in the part of Reform, is garnering all of this interest and curiosity where people are like, ah, I'm willing to lend my support to them.
But
to
do you
see
not
what
think so?
On.
We spoke to two guys. I mean, most of the guys, we spoke to pretty much all guys who wanted to vote for Reform. That's not because we didn't want to speak to women. In fact, most of the women that we asked to speak to us were like, absolutely not. In fact, one of them told me to fuck off. So, I mean, look, we were not in the interest of trying to stitch up anybody. We just literally, we showed what they said to us and we just asked them questions. But all those guys, I just felt that they were fundamentally curious about solving a problem. So they were acknowledging that Britain is in a deep malaise. There's a rot. They wanted to fix it. And they were like, okay, open mind. I'm going to see what these guys are saying. They weren't like ride or die. They weren't UKIP.
And they had a sense of themselves in all of it. I think people had a sense of, and there were people from all different ethnic backgrounds and from all parts of the UK and whatever else. They had a sense of what Britishness meant to them, and in some way that had been lost. And so they were going searching for an aspect of themselves and their identity, it seemed to me. Like, there was no one speaking their language as to who they were as a British person. And I think that's another flaw, is that a bit like what we were saying about what is Britishness today, what is Britishness in relation to a whole host of people with a range of identities, yeah. and how does that correlate to their voting habits?
Yeah, and on that point specifically, Britishness does mean whiteness for a significant part of this country. And I think that when you saw, for instance, that viral clip of Fraser Nelson and Constantine Kissing going back and forth.
I don't think Rishi Sunak is English. We're both British.
I would say that Rishi Sunak is as English as Tizer and Wyfronts, right? He is absolutely English. He was born and bred here. And I wouldn't say that the colour of his skin makes him any
less. He's a brown Hindu. How is he English?
Because he's born and bred here.
Being English doesn't mean being white. But Kissing was... you know, well, really adamant. Was willing to die on that hill because, you know, Britishness, Englishness, those two things are separate, but it's Englishness itself is an ethnic identity. Whereas, but then I don't know how, because I feel, I'm English.
I mean, I was born here, but then I recognise that so, I'm potentially not of that English.
I'm not ethnically English. I'm not ethnically English. I know I'm not ethnically English, but is that what matters? Is what we're saying that really matters is the pigmentation? Is it about hue?
Well, no. Of course, it
isn't. I mean, and I think even Fraser Nelson. This is where the split really lies between like conservatives and reform people, is that your intellectualized Tories like Fraser Nelson will just say, I don't know, man. Like,
yeah, exactly.
That sounds a bit archaic, bro. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm, that sounds yeah, a bit 19th century, fam. Like, we're gonna have to move on from there. Whereas I think what Kissing understands and recognizes, you know, quite acutely. He's a very smart guy, very good storyteller. Is that ethnicity to a part of this population really does matter. And the fact that they've been ignored is what's created that anger, that sense of that the political class are indifferent to me. If worse than that, they have contempt for me. They really don't like me. They don't care. And it's important from Kissing's eyes, I think, to protect those people, to say, yes, you are completely legitimate to champion your ethnic identity. But I think the problem is it coming at the cost of someone else?
Well, I think it's in part because people, particular communities, have been able to a point, leverage their ethnicity in order to get some form of equal access to something. And the same conversation just has not been replicated amongst white, English,
working class people.
And so it's left people without a currency that many other people have to a point been able to
and we know them. And we've lived through this, right? Like, I know you've done a lot of stuff within like DEI, which is like kind of like a dirty word right now with like the way Trump's moving.
Well, but it's more recognizing where there are kind of missed opportunities to have good people because of structural kind of inequities. I don't see it in the kind of D&I politicized way. It's just recognizing where barriers are to certain people, and those barriers exist for a whole range of people, not just people of color, racialized people, women. They exist for people of different class backgrounds.
Absolutely.
And so it's about ensuring almost that people have access. Though. Oh yeah, definitely. Class is the most entrenched aspect of society. If you came from a
poor part of the UK, your access to education is going to be completely different. You know, your access to your community is going to be completely different.
How you engage with institutions and people is also going to be completely different. How people receive you is going to be completely different. Yeah. So to kind of oversimplify it and...
It's a race thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Is really doing...
It's damaging.
It's damaging, but it does kind of the cause of greater social justice and social mobility a disservice, because it says, well, it's only allocated to said group of people and therefore cannot be applied to others who, as we say, have been entrenched in kind of class.
I've never heard it explained in those terms, but I think that's it, right? It's like white working class people didn't have a class lever to pull.
No.
And in, within the conversations about structural inequities.
Because the conversation, to a point... transcended class.
But do you not think it did become a lot about race, though?
Well, this, I mean...
It became a lot about
class
race.
Class was largely overlooked in all of this stuff, and...
And they're inextricably linked in many ways, but it became, for me, I remember feeling at certain points during, like, 2020, like, you're not white, so, like, you have the currency in this conversation to talk... And I'm talking about with my friends and, like, family and stuff like that, other white friends, right? That they were like, okay, you are the person, you're the authority here. And this was a complete beat change because no one gave a shit before. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there was a response to people, especially within those communities, going, hold on, Like, stop talking about this minority. You know, there's a huge block of us who are completely forgotten about.
Well, I think it's also because those people have been speaking about community decline for decades.
Yeah.
And no one has been listening.
Yeah.
And you're right, class and race are inextricably linked. But to reduce it to one dimension of one person's identity can be so binarizing, can be so toxic, and it leaves people without feeling as though they've got some form of currency to leverage to greater advantage themselves. And that's been the toxicity around the whole conversation, is that we've reduced people with a whole range of complex experiences and encounters and needs to one aspect of who they are, and tried to build a world in which we give greater credence based upon that one thing in their life, which is hugely damaging because it pitches one group of people against another. And I mean, as someone of the left, that's never a good thing.
So we left the Reform rally and we're walking, right, trying to find the noise. We can kind of just hear just shreds of it in the distance, of the counter rally. And as we walk by, we see this arrest of this guy getting pulled into the police van. Now, this clip's done a little numbers for a humble platform like us. But all the comments are like saying that this is two-tier policing. I just wanted to kind of throw that to you. What do you think of this whole two-tier policing narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite an easy accusation to level when you see the police responding to particular things that you may agree or disagree with. And that's not to say that policing is applied evenly across the board, because we know historically that it's not, and we know that contemporarily
it's not. It's the irony.
So it's like, it is an irony because, I mean, the people who are levelling the accusation are also then sometimes the same people in the seat, and it kind of goes on and on and on and on. I don't know what I think about it outside of the fact that there obviously needs to be a greater level of confidence in policing.
Yes.
People know that something is not working and that there is an injustice at the heart of it. And so I think that's what fuels the kind of accusation of it being two-tier.
My read of it is that the two-tier policing narrative was born out of actually coming full circle here to the grooming gang stuff, right? So this huge blight on the police involves not wanting to look racist and not interrogating the facts properly in these cases. That was a complete institutional failure. So if you're talking about institutional failure in policing, yeah, that stuff happens all the time, by the way, and quite often to minority ethnic communities. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just do the kind of breakdown in statistics, right? So if you are non-white in this country, you're more likely to live in an area that is poor. If you're likely to live in a poor area, it's likely to have high rates of crime. If you live in a high rate of crime area, it will be a police hotspot, so there'll be a greater police presence. And so the police will police harder in those areas, which means that plenty of innocent people get policed as if they're criminals when they're not. And that is a form of two-tier policing, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because that is a thing of responding statistically when you have a scarcity of resource to the fact that there are all these problems and crimes occurring, and then just being like, okay, we're going to go after where we think those things are happening, looking at the data. I can understand why you do all of those things, but it means that in the minutiae there are these huge injustices that are done.
And there's no kind of social program to alleviate any of these problems. That's where the greatest injustice also happens, is not just the fact that obviously people are more heavily policed in certain parts of the UK, in certain parts of London, in certain parts of big cities, but it's the fact that many of those people are oftentimes left to live in standards that are of destitution, of deep poverty, where the state doesn't dignify these people. And that, I think, is a crime in itself.
Institutional distrust of the police is a zero-sum game, because all good civilians need a police force that's going to protect them. Not just for their peace of mind, because when stuff actually goes wrong, you have to have someone you need to call.
And you need to have confidence that they're going to
sort it out.
Yeah.
And I guess there is a real feeling right now that there is not that connection between communities and the police. And, you know, the loss of Bobbies on Beats and stuff like that has definitely been a massive catalyst
policing.
For that.
Yeah.
People used to know their local police officer. They used to be a member of the community. I you know, you hear stories of people who've gone in, tried to help, and found it to be so institutionally backwards that they were like, even I can't, you know, do this in good faith. I've heard stories like that, but I want to believe in the police. I want to support the police. I want them to do the right thing. I also want to support the communities that feel that they've been hard done by.
Well, they're there for us.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, they're a public service that should serve in public interest. And yeah, if I don't have confidence in the police, that's one person too many as far as I see it. And but,
yeah, bro, this is counterculture though, because there's nothing sexy about being pro-police.
Well,
on the left especially, like,
it's also hard because historically they've given very little reason to be pro-police.
Yeah.
I mean, the treatment of women, treatment of black and brown people in this country, the treatment of working class people in this country.
Yeah.
It's hard to have a staunch defense of the police without, to a point, being blind about history.
And also, they've moved and acted as a gang, you know, often in history. And I think we're pulled in two different directions here, because one side of us needs to be completely honest about those failures. And the other side of us is also recognizing, in like a macro social sense, that if you don't have trust in those things, that's a really bad thing. So we got to the counter reform rally. We were with our people. We were with our tribe. Did you feel represented? Like, not quite our tribe, but you know what I mean.
Well, there were some characters. There were some provocative voices that came through.
Yeah. Like, what about the socialist grandma, Yana?
And is that what you think of the reform supporters?
Yes! Hate them! Idiots! Stupid! Thick!
And even our friend from the Revolutionary Communist
our mate from the RCP.
Yeah, good.
Fuck the law! The law is written by the rich. The law is written to protect private property. We are the Revolutionary Communist Party. We stand for revolution at disregard to the law.
They embody kind of this radical optimism of how the world should be.
Utopia.
And they're so resolute about it, and they're so dogmatized by injustice that takes place in our society. But I also am so mindful that most of the British public, I think actually a lot of people in society around Western democracies, don't want those solutions to the problems that we're experiencing.
Yeah.
Because they are ideological, they are to a point quite extreme in their advocacy of what they're pursuing. And I want to live in a society that respects difference of opinion, that can find consensus to build something alternative, that can still speak to some of the injustices and challenges of the day, but without doing it so almost through aggressive and revolutionary means.
Yeah.
But it was interesting because it was like this parade of joy, where there was a lot of music, beating their drums, a lot of chants, all of this kind of stuff.
There wasn't a lot of boozing.
There wasn't a lot of boozing.
And I feel like that's something you do see a little bit. Like, I've been in like the tube when there's a big like riot demonstration in London, and it's just like, it's a bit of a piss up. Mm-hmm. Like, there wasn't much of that at all, which I thought was interesting. I agree with you on the point of radicalism. Like, we should avoid revolution at all costs.
Yeah,
like, revolution is not kind.
It's also not what British people want. It's not what
we don't have a history of and that's part of because of the structures that we've created around our parliamentary democracy, right?
And I think it would be irresponsible for anybody who's seriously involved in politics to be advocated for any form of revolutionary changes as well, because it is kind of offensive to our history, to how we've evolved, how the changes
it's not serious
and it doesn't deliver the changes that I think it speaks to deliver.
But I think there's also an acknowledgement that, like, if we don't fix some of these problems, the noise and the anger could get to a really ugly place.
Definitely. And sometimes revolutionary kind of acts don't have to take place kind of through a traditional revolution. They can still harvest and harness the institutions of democracy to pursue quite radical and extreme policy programs that could have a revolutionary outcome, and that's not what anybody wants either.
We should do a revolution watch. We should do a thing where, like, every other episode we're looking at serious political tumultuous change across the world to try and understand why that thing happens, and also why it needs to be avoided at all costs. For the left, what really struck me was their acknowledgement that the reform voters were responding to something that was wrong in British society, that they were accepting, yes, these people have been hard done by to a certain degree, but they were just so disgusted by the prescription of what the right is pushing that they didn't feel to me like they necessarily would want to engage with them directly on a personal level. It felt like it was, you know, and I get this because I was really, really like a big leftist when I was a teenager. And there was a bit of a, you know, I'm not going to talk to you if you don't believe that human rights are legit sort of thing. And this kind of, it was a moralizing around politics. And I don't have any friends who don't believe human rights or a thing, but
I think that kind of ultra moralizing position can justify how they can say, well, they're all fascists, they're all this, they're all that, they're all the other. I'm like you, I don't have many friends who take those kind of
I don't have any friends who vote for reform. No,
yeah,
no,
exactly.
I don't.
But in all of that, that is, I think, to a point also symptomatic of the problem that is also existing of people on the left who are so entrenched within their camp and don't want to
engage. So maybe we should have reform friends.
Well, I mean, it would just be curious to see why people are going that way. Yeah. I mean, I don't think there are particularly bad people on both sides. I think there are people who are passionate about seeing a different type of society, and in their passion can be quite quick and haste to say, well, this person's that, or this person's they're destroying our democracy. And that's not to say that elements of what they're saying are not true, because I very much believe that what some political parties and what some people associated with them are trying to do are very divisive. But in all of it, you can't say everyone attached to the movement is said person. And that's the discourse that I fear we're going down.
Well, solving division is probably not done via name calling. If you name call anyone, they're not going to want to listen to what you have to say, because they're going to think, you just called me a dickhead, why the hell should I listen to you? You know, or you called me a fascist. There's certain things that are going on right now in America that are absolutely authoritarian and fascistic. And I'm thinking about this in terms of, like, how do I don't think Farage has the answers for this country. How do we stop reform from winning? America went down this route of saying, look, Donald Trump is essentially an autocrat, he's a fascist, and he's going to renege on all of the rights that you hold dear. And it didn't work. It just didn't work. It didn't work. And I just think that if we try to roll out the same American playbook against Farage, we'll find the same results. People are desperate for a system that works. They don't care anymore.
Fear-mongering, I don't think, will ever work, especially when people have an alternative that they're projecting and proposing to their electoral base or whatever. We've got to have something that we are fighting for rather than something that we're fighting against. And I think it's quite clear what reform are fighting for. They want lower levels of immigration in this country. They want to depart from the ECHR. As the left, we've got to say, well, what do we want to see as a society? Yeah, what is our offering to you guys? How are
we need a positive vision.
We need a positive vision. But also, we need to remind people that we are kind of the 99% of society, and they represent the interests of the 1% in our society.
Yes, yes.
And
In wealth terms,
yeah. And I think their parliamentary record will demonstrate that, that they're not on the side of ordinary working class people. They're not on the side of the institutions that we hold dear around the welfare state. They don't want to have any accountability of people who make money, vast amounts of money, exploitatively here or overseas. This is a huge problem. We've just got to remind ourselves who we are and the people that we're advocating for and what type of system we want to live under.
Yeah, but this is what makes me fucking sick. It makes me sick the way that reforms say that they are anti-elite. They say they have positioned themselves as the opposition to the elite. And it's like, hold on, you are in the pocket of the biggest wealth in this country. Like, fossil fuels injects money into reform, and they have the gall to tell us, yeah, nah, actually we're on the sides against elites. They are the elite, right? The elite will shapeshift. Ultra wealth will shapeshift into whatever it needs to be to protect its wealth.
Yeah.
And I just think this is what makes me feel like we are in an absolute... that's why I think reform is the opposition, because I'm like, if they're able to do that, we're cooked. We're actually cooked, because the whole point of the labour movement was to ultimately support the worst off in society. And if the top 1% can say on social politics, for instance, you agree with us, you know, a big proportion of the burst off in society, then they will take you know, actions to maim themselves in pursuit of this nostalgic golden vision for the future, which, by the way, won't cater for their interests. So, yeah, man, I just, I'm of the opinion that reform is the thing we need to worry about. Like, I just, where is Kemi Badenoch? I mean, where has she been?
I think it's, I think to a point you're right, reform is something that does need to be considered with a level of concern. But I think this is a moment for the government to have greater confidence in what it can actually do to transform the lives of ordinary people. Have that program in place and say, well, we want to see a new type of society. We want to build the institutions for tomorrow. We want to ensure that there is greater levels of employment. We want to ensure that the social and welfare state is there to last another century going forward. We have to have conviction in the things that we want to do. Yes, of course, be mindful of your opponents, but don't lose track of the things that you can actually do whilst you have the power as it stands today.
Part of me is reticent to say reform is the opposition, because reform wants to be the opposition. They want to be legitimized through the government thinking of them as the thing to watch out for, because it makes them seem like a genuine possibility electorally.
It gives them greater credibility.
Yeah, exactly. But this is not UKIP anymore, man. And this is why Nigel Farage has done all these rebrands. You know, this is why the local elections also is going to be really important, because we're going to see how professionalized reform actually is as a campaigning vehicle. And this is something that the media might not report on as much, because it's not quite that sexy, pounding the pavement and knocking people's doors. But can reform, they've got all these candidates, they've got the most candidates apparently that they're fielding out of all the main parties for the locals. How many will get in? Will they be organised enough to do what they need to do to get in? Or does actual boots on the ground campaigning even matter anymore, right? Because if we're talking about the media treat reform as the opposition, right? There's four MPs, not five, four, right? Four MPs, and they get so much coverage.
And if they were able to kind of rack up their own funds as a party, they've got the resources to have to do as little campaigning as possible, little personal campaigning as possible. They can just drop leaflets and leaflets and leaflets and leaflets endlessly and get their message across. And this is what I fear when we say, are they a real opposition? If we give them too much credence, they start to become the real opposition.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, this is it, exactly. And I think we've just got to hold tight to the fact that we are in government and we can actually do all of these things and upend a whole consensus that has destroyed huge communities up and down the country. We've got to stay kind of steadfast and strong to that mission of what we're trying to achieve. I just fear that if we're getting too sidetracked and giving them too much credence, bloviating their roles and their kind of positions in the House of Commons, yeah, well, they could very well become the opposition in Parliament.
Okay, so maybe I'm victim to the reality I don't want to live in. I'm talking it into existence. I don't want to do that. But I guess that there's also a thing of, if you just believed in self-fulfilling prophecies and you kept saying them, they fulfilled themselves, then you'd just always be right about the future. Well, and that would be great as well. Now, we're not 100% sure. Reform want to be the opposition is something that we're definitely agreed on.
It's obvious.
Yeah, whether they will be seems to be both a function of whether we can actually execute the missions that we need to, but also whether we treat them as such in the pursuit of that, of executing those missions. And I think where you and I perhaps depart slightly is that I think that there is something substantive going on in their analysis about why the country's failing, what they're trying to respond to. But I'm also accepting that there is stuff that is just kind of like, it's vibes based, it's noise, it's culture wars, etc. And I think if I'm right, you're saying that don't worry too much about that culture warsy stuff, because it's fugazi. It's a fugazi. Just execute a positive, clear vision that makes working people's lives
better. I don't think it's that simple, because I think that has to coexist with a grand campaign and understanding the fact that society is changing, the country is changing, so we've got to be receptive to that. But in all of it, I just don't think we can get too sidetracked. I think
focus on us.
I mean
concentrate on you, big bro.
Well, this is it. I mean, you have to run your own race. we've got a set of values and principles that we want to see: alleviation of poverty, greater wealth redistribution, accountability on some of the wealthiest people in our society, greater infrastructure created in our society, secure kind of borders, whatever that means to whoever. If people have greater confidence that our immigration system is working, if people have greater confidence that the immigration system is also just in all of that, that people who
fair.
Are
it's fair,
it's reasonable. That is, I think, the value of this government, or it should be the value of this government. And I think it is absolutely possible, provided they stick to the plan. But if they're willing to kind of concede political territory to the right wing, we're only going to just follow them down a really scary and dark path, I think, for the country, let alone for parliamentarians. I mean, that's by the by. It's what is the future of this country fundamentally?
I think I agree with everything you've said in terms of its spirit, like in terms of like the emotionally the mission that we're trying to perform. I think that Labour people, from my experience of them, agree with you as well, but we haven't executed that. And I think what this we need to do through this show is to really understand why those things haven't happened. Is it because Labour doesn't want to actually take you know, help poor people? That's not true. It's just not my experience of everyone who working in the party is that's the reason why they got into politics. So why are we not making those choices that would
and
lead
it's not even
into
it's
a
not in a kind of that. I'd also add, it's not in a kind of patronizing sense to help people. It's to ensure that where agency has been lost, where there's been the decline of community, where people have been denied the opportunity to help themselves, that that sense of self is completely regained. That was always the point of the Labour movement, to ensure that ordinary working class people had the access and opportunity to make their lives better.
Yes,
that was the point of Labour. That is still the point of Labour. That's why I'm here. That's, I'm sure, why you're here.
Absolutely.
It's not just about helping people. It's about ensuring that the most can come from that person, because I mean, it's a
giving people agency.
And a sense of collective prosperity.
That's what's left.
That's that's what's left. That is my what's left.
We spent a lot of time talking before about whether we could find this, you know, unicorn, the Gen Z male reform voter. There's a few that kind of like walked by but didn't want to speak to us. And then at the end, we finally got one young man who's supporting reform, and he said stuff about race and actually blew up a little bit on TikTok. I think people think on TikTok that we might be a pro-reform page, so we're going to have to sort that out a little bit.
The what I get told, well, your skin colour doesn't reflect the party that you support. But if you actually listen to reform and don't make up nonsense, you actually realise they stand for British values, not one specific skin colour.
Again, I think this is kind of the future of the UK. There is greater nuance and greater sophistication around people's histories, people's identities, and how that corresponds to what they want to see in their society and who ultimately they're going to vote for. And this guy so eloquently put forward himself as a person with his own kind of cultural history, with his own sense of identity, and why he felt Farage was an alternative, and why the mainstream parties did not speak to him. This is something that everyone is going to have to, I think, grapple with at a point, because what is it to be British, and do certain communities naturally have a tendency to voting for certain people? And I think we have to break that cycle, because people should vote for who is serving their interests fundamentally. And the idea that you can be aligned or allied to a particular party or movement of people based upon race, I think, is increasingly becoming...
It's for the birds now, man.
It's for the birds, exactly. It's a dying opinion to be had.
Yeah.
But in all of that, there is a greater nuance as to how politics then has to respond to these things. Politics is no longer black and white, up or down, rich and poor,
left and right,
Yeah, it's none of these things. Exactly. And people are looking for new alternatives. He spoke to a new generation of Brits, I thought, exercised their own political agency, because both the Labour and the Tories have a record in government. People can turn to both parties and say, well, you guys said this, and you guys done this, and you guys did this, and what about this, and what about that? There is something new and fresh with reform, and I think that's one of the most interesting things, and arguably potentially one of the most dangerous things, because we don't really know what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
But you've got people from all demographics in the country who are interested and curious and willing to support them until maybe that record is blemished. So I don't know kind of what I thought about him specifically, but I just thought he made a really insightful and intelligent contribution, as much as I kind of disagree with his support. These are the people that we've got to listen and learn from, because we both want what is best for the country, but he's obviously got a very different way in which he achieves it.
I just heard a small C conservative is what I heard, but now he's gone to reform. Like, he's just a kid who didn't go to uni, went straight into work, wasn't happy about... His other mate was complaining about taxes, so that's like, for young people to be, that's their first issue. There's a really interesting lens that they have to be taking, and some life choices as well that stand out. But he just struck me as someone who would have, in previous eras, found a home for him in the Tories. He definitely, there's nothing about what he said that was fascistic. There was nothing about what he said that was leaning into any of that territory where the left would name call.
Yeah, of course. He wasn't far right.
No, of course he wasn't. No, and from his experience, he'd gone and tasted the reform fruit and not seen any far rightness. Now, whether that there's some blindness to some spots there, I don't know. But you've got to take this person in good faith and at face value. So I think, the problem I have is if we go into a place of throwing these voters into a pile of, well, they're bad people, then you lose someone who actually seems to be on the face of it fairly sensible. The one bit I kind of stuck out to me, and I should have asked this to him in the interview, was his thing about, it doesn't really matter your background and where you come from, but like, what class this young man would describe himself as coming from. You know, would he describe himself as being a working class lad?
Yeah.
He was very articulate, very eloquent, and I'm not going to judge based off your accent. You know, everyone can code switch. But I just thought that was something that I wanted to tease out a bit more, just to get a bit more of a picture about the type of voter that this person is and how Farage has kind of won him over. I understand on one level why he feels that the conversation about race just became a little bit too much about what people looked like and not about who they were.
Who he was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there are plenty of mixed race people I know who feel that way, that, you know, too black for the white kids, too white for the black, brown, whatever. And have just got to a place where they go, I don't want to use or play the race card. I don't even want to be seen to be someone who cares about this thing, because, to be honest, I feel indifferent to it. And as a mixed race person, I get that. Like, it's liminal, bro. You're living on the boundaries all the time. And so, in some ways, psychologically, it's easier to say, I'm just going to not engage with this part of my identity. But I guess what he thought left-wing politics had become, to a certain degree, was characterised specifically how people looked.
And in all of that, I think a caricature of then their attitudes and potentially attributes as to how politics and politicians receive and respond to them. He just seemed like somebody who wanted to exercise independent thinking, someone who was curious, who didn't let any aspect of his identity inform or dictate or dogmatise how he should engage.
He did not want to be told what to think.
Yeah, exactly.
And
that instinctively to me is a very British thing.
I mean, 100%.
British people are, rightfully so, the most independent minded people.
British people will think something, you'll go, you think that, and they'll go, I don't think that. And they'll go, no, I think, and then they'll say the opposite.
Well, exactly, and that I think it's a good thing to be independently minded. It's just more, for me, it's not the issues with people like that by any means, it's the fact that potentially people like that feel as though they don't have a space to have a conversation, and then can be dragged down maybe a further right-wing path or a further kind of extreme path where you do enter silos and all of a sudden views seem quite isolated and provocative and, to a point, nonsensical. They become radical and not serving of the original intention.
Yeah. Stubbornness can become a way of, like,
creating ignorance.
Yeah, it can metastasize into being an agitator, into being someone who wants to get a reaction out of people and wind people up and stuff like
that. Yeah, exactly.
But people who do that fundamentally don't feel listened to, they don't feel accounted for. I don't think people become trolls for no reason. I think they become trolls because they're desperately unhappy about something else going on in their life. Not to justify them, just to explain them. So, yeah, look, I don't think he was necessarily in the troll camp, but I think if you gave him enough abuse, he would become a reform candidate, because he'd probably be like, well, you guys are just tallying up with my understanding and expectation of what the left is, sort of.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would not be shocked, by the way, if this young man did become a reform candidate. I didn't catch his name, but he's a really eloquent guy. You know, he's definitely got a bright future ahead of him.
And he seems, I think, like all of us who are involved in politics and interested in politics, he seems minded about the future of the country.
Yeah.
And that can never be understated, and that should never be weaponized as something that is bad against people. And this young man felt as though it was appropriate, and he feels sympathetic towards reform. I don't, and that's fine. We live in a democracy. That's one of the great things about it. Yeah. But at least by having that conversation with him, it breaks down these kind of sweeping statements that both camps like to level against each other. It fosters a greater sense of understanding, and it means that we can at least try and inject a new sense of nuance into how the world is kind of developing, and to try and bring the pace back to a level where people can feel confident and digest it much more easily, because things are just going so fast and so out of control and ever more binary by the day that is not a sustainable way of conducting any form of political affairs, because our society will completely run away with itself and quite crazy things will happen.
I'm worried about an increasingly radicalized electorate, and a black and white worldview is one of the biggest predeterminants of a radical worldview, right? You're an extremist, sees the world through light versus dark, good versus evil, and they don't admit any shades of grey. And unfortunately, the answers to most of the problems that we're trying to seek out live in those areas of nuance, gray zone. And we have to have the confidence and the self-belief to excavate in those places without, and the ability to get things wrong without going, you know, you're an evil person, you're a bad person. We need to believe that people can be good faith actors again, because otherwise we're just going to go in a merry-go-round of hatred, really.
Well, and also there are going to be experiences in the future where, as a country, as a global society, we're going to have to come together and we're going to have to work with people towards a collective solution. I'm thinking about things around climate change, potential global conflict. Yeah. We're seeing the impacts of tariffs around the world. We've got to have a sense of ourselves as individuals, but as a community, reinstill the capacity to work together and respect people's opinions, but not be so toxic about other people for having certain opinions.
We want to build a community with this. So if you're interested and enjoying what we've had to say, please subscribe, drop a comment. We're going to probably set up a Discord server at some point and a proper online digital community. We're trying to bring community back. Come on. Communal we. That was a concept idea I came up with. My mate said it sounded like a piss shiwi type style advert, so deaded that one still. But please leave a comment. We'd love to hear from you. We believe in direct democracy, so tell us why you disagree. Avoid abuse if possible. If you can't help it, I understand. But thank you. This has been What's Left. This is episode 1. We'll be back again in the future.
Thank you.